Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m. Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com. We also archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. We encourage you also to go to the link to our guests' website and check out the information that they have to impart to you. Glean what you can, as always. This is a smorgasbord, so you can come to the table and just take bits and pieces that you'd like that are tasty for you, that satisfy you, that maybe even a higher perspective that even serve you. And we encourage you to do that so that you can continue to move forward in making your life that which you would like it to be in terms of greater, in terms of more fulfillment, in terms of more peace, if that's possible in some instances. We're going to kind of go down that road, so to speak. And oftentimes I've used the analogy when it comes to choices and knowledge of those choices. I use the analogy of a fork in the road. Now, the analogy starts out with you walking along the curbside, and you have the white line as the shoulder of the roadway, and you have been told to, because there's a great heavy fog that's always about, just to look down, follow that white line, and you will be fine, you'll be safe, everything is good, and that is true. And you can certainly do that to the end of your days. But all of a sudden, one day, the fog lifts, and suddenly you see a fork in the road, another path off to the side. I don't want to say left or right because it kind of connotes a lot of other things, but it diverges from the path you've been taking. Now you have a choice. You can continue to follow that line, which is perfectly acceptable. There's nothing wrong with doing that. Or you can step out of that comfort zone of yours, which is a comfortable place, and you can try something new, try something different. That's what we try to provide here for you, is that something different. And along those lines, I think quite appropriately, we're going to be talking with the author of The Narrow Way. It's a memoir of coming out, getting clean, and finding Buddha. There's going to be an interesting twist to that third one, though, as we continue on our program here, talking with the author, Chris Lemig. And I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program, Chris. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Richard. It's a great pleasure to be here. I appreciate you inviting me. And I'm looking forward to our talk today.
I find it fascinating that we all have gone through transitions in our lives, whether they be the milestones that, like you and I as men, might travel at the age of 16. Maybe we would get our driver's license, and 18, sure. We get at one point we get to vote, and then at 21, you know, we get to drink, or maybe that other transitioning period. For some, our first sexual experience, or we get married, right. And so on and so forth. We have all of those landmark places that we traverse, and we all have them. I mean, it's right. Not unique to one person. But right. you found the necessity, I'll put it that way, to put it down into words, those transition points in your life.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Tell me why.
I think that, like you're alluding to here, you know, in for all human beings and all cultures, you know, we do have these milestones in our lives, these moments that mark transitions from one phase of our life into another, you know, especially, you know, say from childhood into adulthood is a big one, you know, and in most, all cultures, in fact, they all have events or ceremonies or experiences that people go through that define who they are becoming. And the culture allows them or gives them the tools that they need and the definitions that they need to understand who they are and how they're going to relate then to their society. And I think for myself, I didn't really have that, you know, those things that you mentioned, like getting your driver's license and, you know, first sexual experience and things like that were, although important to me, the experience that I was needing, the transitionary experience that I was desperately in need of in my life, was recognizing who I was in terms of my sexual orientation. So so because I kind of missed that and it kind of got brushed underneath the rug, as it were, and buried for so many years until I was 36, in fact, that was the time that I was able to actually fully embrace, you know, who I was. I found myself for most of my adult life just kind of wandering around going like, who am I, you know, and feeling extremely confused. And that confusion was actually really painful because I just didn't know how to relate to the rest of the world and fit in with the rest of the world. And so I always felt, you know, just out of phase, as it were. So that realization of who I was as a gay man, when I was able to come to terms with that and fully accept that and in fact celebrate it, was such a profound shift for me. My life just completely changed into a totally different direction. It was a 180 degree turnaround. So rather than continuing down a path of self-destruction and self-hatred and, you know, in the end, probably would have turned into going through with a suicide, I wound up discovering that life was full of the possibility of joy and fulfillment and meaning. And so it was just a huge, profound experience for me. And I was just like so excited and so, you know, full of happiness. I was like, I got to share this with people, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's why I wrote the book.
Well, I know too that we share a common experience, and that is wanting to fit in.
Right.
Wanting to find our place, shall we say, in the universe.
Sure.
What's interesting is before we started this interview, I was listening to one of my favorite artists, John Denver, I kid you not, I'm serious. I was actually listening to the song "Looking for Space."
Okay. Yeah.
Trying to find out who I am.
Right.
And trying to know and understand.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find interesting in this process is that for me, being here in the brief puff of smoke, we'll call 56 years.
Yeah.
I'm still searching. I've been doing these interviews with this format, this program, for over 9 years, but I've been interviewing since I was 19, 20 years of age.
Yeah.
And I've been on my search since I was 17. And I'm still not sure. There are times when I am still not sure how and where, in spite of all of the wonderful accolades I might receive for some of the work that I do and how connected I feel when I'm doing the work that I'm doing, whether it's these interviews or production and that kind of thing. And I'm thinking, is this really me? Is this really how I fit in?
Right.
I keep feeling like there's still something. It's like all of the cogs in the wheel haven't quite meshed yet.
Sure.
And I have a feeling that I'm not alone. Maybe my dad, who is 85, probably still has that same sense of feeling. And maybe we all, as human beings, we go through that where we're always searching for that way to fit.
Sure.
And it's never 100% perfect. Might be 95%, 98%, but it's always that 2 to 5% that you're still saying, gee, I wish I could just turn that just a little bit more.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think that, there's a couple ways to look at it. You know, I think, you know, in a sense, what we're trained to look for in our lives, at least in Western culture here, is some sort of finality, some sort of like final answer or solution to the question of life, if you were, at the end we arrive at some final destination where we're like, this is it. I've made it. I've done it. I'm finished. I'm complete. And I think that that's kind of the wrong, you know, not the wrong way. I don't like to use the word wrong, but it's just a mistaken way of going about the whole thing, in a sense. Because, you know, like the cliche goes, you know, it's not the destination, it's the journey. And our lives are just continuously unfolding, and they're always going to be unfolding. And there really is no end to existence. There is no end to our consciousness. You know, our consciousness is eternal. The things that are manifesting out of that consciousness, the things that we can see around us, the relationships that we have, the work that we do, the things that we're focused on in the moment, all these things are adventitious and continuously changing. So so if we focus on those external things rather than the sort of our true nature, which is, you know, indestructible and unchanging, then we're always going to be looking outside going like, the pieces aren't quite fitting all together. They're constantly changing. They're always jumbling about, and we're maybe going to fall into the a trap maybe of just feeling always dissatisfied with how things are. So I think that's the thing. You know, we have to look at our lives as being, an ongoing adventure. Our lives are a process of continually learning and continually growing and developing. And we need to celebrate that and just be like, you know, yeah, this is great. You know, I'm learning something new all the time. Mm. And my view is always being, refined and, and made clearer and sharper. And that's great. And sometimes it's going to be, we're going to be confused again. And we're going to be like, oh, man, what have I learned anything at all? Well, that's okay, too. You know, we need to accept those moments as well.
The Narrow Way is the title of the book. Chris Lemming is my guest, and we're talking about these different aspects of his life in particular. Now, you've already talked and addressed the subject of coming out.
Sure.
And I have to say that my best friend, who I grew up through grade school, high school, and college with, and we still are connected, we still have a relationship, even though he's still living in Phoenix, I remember the day he came out to me.
Yeah.
And he shared this with me, and I just looked at him and I said, what do you want me to do with that? I mean, is that supposed to make a difference? It doesn't.
Right,
you're still
right.
My best friend.
Right,
I just want
right.
you to be happy. And then, of course, yeah. I would hear the stories over the years of yeah. of his different partners he would come across, the different boyfriends that he would have, and the happiness or unhappiness and what have you, yeah. the trials and tribs. And yeah. I remember recently after his going through, I think what he might describe as his dark night of the soul, which went on for yeah. several years after yeah. losing his mother and then his house and then his job and living in his car and mm-hmm. calling me wanting some help. And all I could offer him was some advice. I said, you have a network there that you have established, because he's lived there. Well, he and I, we were both born and raised in Phoenix.
Sure.
And I says, you need to go to some of these people and say, look, I just need some help for a short period of time until I get myself back on my feet.
Yeah.
He's back on his feet again, and I went to visit him. And I remember when I was texting him before our trip, he says, can't talk now, can't call you. Am at Disneyland. The moment I knew he was at Disneyland, I'm going, the guy is a happy guy, because
right,
that is
right.
one of his favorite places to go.
Great.
So, his coming out didn't change our relationship, didn't make any difference to me. And as far as I know, he didn't go down that second road that you talk about in terms of getting clean. And you dealt with your own demons as far as addiction. Share that
sure.
with us.
Sure. Well, yeah. It was very, very challenging for me. But it's not my exclusive experience, of course. I know many, many people. Obviously, there's many people who have issues with addiction for many different reasons. But in terms of this inability to reconcile one's, sexuality and to accept one's sexuality, this is a big problem in the LGBT community, addiction and drug abuse and depression, mm-hmm. Suicide, these sorts of things are really serious problems that are being addressed but need to be addressed even more. And there's just this general sense in our society, which is changing. There's no doubt about it, especially in the past. Well, over the past 30 or 40 years, things mm-hmm. have been gradually changing. Homosexuality, bisexuality, transgenderism, all these things have been more and more so been coming out into the light of our society. People mm-hmm. are seeing them and accepting things more and more. But there's still, this bias that says that there's something wrong with people who, have a different sexuality. So, and it's been really extreme, the further back in history that we go, to the point where to come out meant that you might be disowned by your family, you might be excommunicated from your community, you might be persecuted, you might even be, beaten and killed. killed. You know, these are not uncommon stories. So as a result of all this, you know, sort of negative, this negative view that society has had of you know, people with different ways of expressing their sexuality, you know, people are afraid to own up to who they are. They're afraid to come out to their family and friends. And so they wind up internalizing a lot of this homophobia within themselves. And so this this self-hatred and this self-loathing way of thinking, these negative patterns of thinking and living start to rule our lives. And so turning to drugs and alcohol is very common. So that's what happened for me. And I wasn't able to just at all accept who I was. I really was very deep in the closet, as they say, meaning that I was hiding my sexuality, not only from others, but also from myself, to the point where I convinced myself that I wasn't gay at all. And so because there was this, you know, inner conflict all the time, I was in a lot of pain. And so of course, I was looking for a way to relieve that pain. And so I sought drugs and alcohol as a way to self-medicate. And this process, just unfortunately, it was a cycle of self-destruction that went on for almost over two decades, really, about 23 years. So it was a long, dark road, just out of control drinking, out of control drug use, two suicide attempts. And this didn't end until I really just came to a crux in my life where I would just felt horrible physically. And I just realized and sat down in a moment of clarity where I was, attempting to get sober for the first time. And I just was able to look at myself a little more clearly and just say to myself, look, I need to make a choice here. Either I need to stop this or I'm going to die. So which is it going to be? And there were two very clear choices for me. And it took a while to come to the conclusion that I finally did. But finally, I was like, look, I need to own up to being gay. I need to tell people about it. And then I'll just take it from there. And fortunately for me, the experience wound up being extremely positive and a really amazing experience of coming out to my family and friends.
You know, having grown up in this industry, initially working for 15 years for a Christian radio station, I heard all the stuff.
Uh-huh.
And in the last 5 or 10 years, I had the great privilege. I have to say that some of my favorite guests are rabbis.
Oh, great.
And I was discussing this very subject with a rabbi, and he says, do you know? And first of all, there are 613 laws, if you will, Jewish laws in the Old Testament.
Okay.
And of course, people want to take that one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
And they want to lay it down on you. And I'm going, well, okay, now that's one. Now you have 612 more that you have to incorporate into your life, because you can't have one without all of the, you have to take them all or you don't take any of them.
Sure.
Well, what he shared with me was so fascinating. And people can research this if they want. I take the word of this rabbi. It's not that he was necessarily in favor or against, but he says this is the tradition. This is the history, the context.
Yeah.
He says that that was not laid down because it was wrong to do. It was because it was a prohibition because it interfered with the procreative process of man.
Sure.
That was it.
Yeah.
Well,
right.
Here
right.
we are in the 21st century, and I don't think the procreative process of man is in any danger of stopping because we have so many different methods now. If you want to have, Chris, wanted to have a child with your DNA, you could do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you're not in violation of that in that context, as this rabbi shared this. And I thought that was so fascinating. Now, is all of that true? I'm accepting this rabbi's commentary at face value because it makes sense. It's that was one of the struggles that I had working at the Christian station was most of what I was told didn't make any sense. It's kind of like there's a passage in the Bible that speaks to let us sit down and reason together. Well, what do you use when you reason? You use your brain. You use critical thinking and problem solving. Mm-hmm. Okay? You think things through logically. And when I started thinking through logically some of the conclusions that some of these folks were making back in the 80s and early 90s, it just didn't make sense.
Right, right.
And when I thought about this in context of my best friend, I thought, Wouldn't it be better if he found happiness than tried to force? I mean, he did have a girlfriend for a while.
Sure.
When we
sure.
were in college. Even in high school.
Yeah.
He tried to do that.
Yeah.
And I could tell he was not happy.
Yeah.
You know, not only in terms of the dynamics of the male-female relationship, but just in terms of just not working for him.
Sure. Sure.
And of course, I never had any inklings, but it didn't matter. But I find that one of the things that we just cut off when it comes to beliefs, and this is even true in so many other areas of our lives, politics as well, especially after the cycle we've been through. Lord, I can't believe what we just went through.
Yeah.
Craziness. But
right.
What I find interesting is that you found something. And this is where, folks, the twist of the change comes in, and we'll share this in a moment. But this is where you found something or someone, we'll say a philosophy,
right,
that served you.
Sure.
And that you took on, we'll say, the mantle, the robes, so to speak.
Quite literally.
Quite literally. of a particular philosophical bent, if you will, that has brought you to where you are today.
Yeah.
And that is Buddha, finding Buddha. And I remember, and you'd know better than I, but I remember reading about Buddha. And of course, I believe, we have a cat by the name of Siddhartha.
Okay, right.
And that is Buddha's given name at birth, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Right. Gautama Siddhartha.
And he, when he became the Buddha, I believe, mm-hmm. was he not sitting, and you help me with this story. He was sitting under a tree, and he was grappling with this paradox. I think it was, and again, I'm not sure if it was with enlightenment, you know, how do I achieve that, or peace, what have you. And it was like, the more you struggled to get there, you would never get there. And that you just had to surrender.
Right.
And until you surrendered, you would never achieve it.
Sure.
But you had to give up the achieving, you know what I'm saying?
I think there's the
phrase that goes, become part of the process. Don't try to control it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, that was the, you know, his sort of revolutionary discovery, you know, and that was his whole purpose in his life. You know, he was looking for the ultimate solution to the question of, you know, human suffering. Why is it that we suffer so much? And why is it that there seems to be no end to that suffering, no matter how hard we strive, how hard we work? And he did. He renounced worldly life, and he said, you know what, worldly life is not going to get me where I want to go. I'm going to become a meditator and go out and study spirituality. And he did. He did that for a long time, and he did it very intensely for many years. And he studied with many great teachers. And he did. You know, he was a very adept spiritual student, actually, and he quickly surpassed all of his teachers one by one in terms of their knowledge and realization. And then he decided, okay, I'm going to go out in the forest now. I'm going to, you know, not eat anything, and this body is the big problem, and I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to eat, I'm not going to drink anything except what I absolutely need to survive. And he did all these very severe, austere aesthetic practices to try to become enlightened, to become free from suffering, to attain liberation. These are all the catch words, you know, that we use. And to ultimate happiness, ultimate, you know, enlightenment, whatever you want to call it. And he found that none of that was working either. So then finally, a young woman came to him one day while he was meditating under a tree and gave him a bowl of rice milk. And he decided that he was going to drink it and say, like, okay, you know, I'm trying too hard. I'm just going to relax into this now. And so he took the food, and immediately he was, you know, rejuvenated, the story goes. And he sat there and he said, okay, this is it. I'm going to do it now. And I'm just going to sit here. I'm not going to get up from this spot underneath the Bodhi tree until I attain enlightenment. And then he finally did. And it was this sort of this letting go of striving and just allowing himself to resume his true nature without anything added to it or taken away from it. And that's what happened. He attained enlightenment at that point.
Mm. I'm gratified, A, by a remembrance of the story from your standpoint, having studied it as well. But I'm also gratified by the fact that I remembered enough of it. Because it's been a while since I read the story.
Yeah, that was great, yeah.
But I was so intrigued by the fact that he's sitting there under the Bodhi tree, and it's like, oh, okay, I guess I'm just going to have to stop what I've been doing I've been chasing that which you can't chase.
You can't.
You know. And we all, you know, it's like, And there's sort of the paradox with this radio program, too, because it's like, okay, we're going to make all these choices available to you. We're going to put out this smorgasbord,
right.
And it's like, you know what? We're not going to do this anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, we are. But I mean, that's sort of the paradox. And I know that's, that is true in a lot of the different philosophies throughout the ages that have tried to share this with us. And when we come back, Chris. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to let you know just exactly what it is, that little twist in the story for Chris, the title would be Buddhist monk. Is that right?
That's what I was a Buddhist monk.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about that when we come back. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. New paradigms for a new world, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Stay tuned.
Tell me your story.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Chris Lemig, and he is the author of The Narrow Way. These are his memoirs. I sometimes wonder, Chris, because yours is not a huge tome or anything. It's not like War and Peace or something, or the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Right.
And if you don't know what that is, folks, Google it. it's a small little volume. And I often think, well, my gosh, if I'm going to write about my life, it should be fairly comprehensive, one would think.
Right.
You know, it's more along the lines of, in this case, and I think this is probably accurate, you're hitting both the high points as well as the low points.
sure. Exactly. Well, I had a process of reasoning as I was writing the book. I had this subtitle from the very beginning, a memoir of coming out, getting clean, and finding Buddha. And as I was compiling stories from my life and deciding what to put in and what to not put in, I kept coming back to that subtitle and saying, like, okay, do these stories relate to those three things? And the thing is, especially with the getting clean part and the pre-getting clean part, there were so many stories of just abject suffering and just bad choices and ridiculous things that I've done that I was like, you know what? I don't really need to beat a dead horse here, as it were. I just wanted to hit some of the highlights, and I thought it was better that way to just, not go into excruciating detail, because there's so many wonderful addiction memoirs out there that have, really shown you in great detail the horrors of a life of addiction. So I really wanted to focus more on the post coming out and getting clean part, and that part has only been a short part of my life so far, or up at that point it had been a extremely short part of my life. So I was just hitting the highlights at that point, and I thought it was fine, to just be, hey, I was a bit self-conscious about it. I was like, oh, it's 190 pages. Is that my life?
That's it.
And I was like, oh, well, of course
the
not.
FBI has a longer file on me.
Exactly. So I did just kind of say, that's fine. It's a quick read. It's a fast read. And I thought that it kind of got to the point that I wanted to get to. And that is that no matter how difficult our lives are, no matter how tragic our lives may be, there is potential. There is potential that we can change and that we can find meaning in our lives, and our lives can become more or less, happy affairs, filled with some joy and purpose. So,
Well, and I know, too, that that's one of the things that we're all striving for is that the joy as well as the purpose. That's a tough one for a lot of folks.
Really tough.
I look at my life, and there's part of me that has felt for many, many years that I was either born under a lucky star or, you know, what have you, because I was fortunate. My father, who as 85, gave me a lot of great advice, and the best of all was be sure that you find a job that you love doing, because you're going to do it. You're going to be doing it for a long time.
Yeah.
He says, I don't want you to get stuck like me.
Mm.
And I understand that from one perspective, but from another perspective, I'm thinking, yeah, but you know, you are where you are today because of the job or jobs that you took on.
Sure.
You know, and I mean, I remember him going when he was still working at the place called Rocky Mountain Banknote Company, I believe was what it was. Mm-hmm. He, in the 70s, he went back to college, went back to junior college, Phoenix College, and he got himself educated into computer programming. And this is back when they had the punch cards and the giant fanfold paper, which we loved at home as kids. Yeah. Lots of stuff to play with and draw on and what have you. But I look at that and I have often thought, I've had very few jobs in my time. Mm-hmm. I've been lucky to stay at a lot of radio stations for a long period of time. Longest 15 years. And then now the second longest is going on 9,
mm-hmm.
Which is unheard of in this business.
Yeah.
So I've been fortunate. But at the same time, there have been some jobs that I've taken on that, you know, you'd look at those going, what the heck does that have to do with, you know, your life's purpose and so forth? I've never thought of that as wasted time. There's something there, something. And so there's no wasted time, if you will, or wasted experience. It's are you willing to take a moment, step back, observe it, and say, okay, what have I learned in that process that I can take with me forward? In other words, there's nothing. Don't throw anything out just yet.
Exactly. I totally agree with you. I think it's an extremely important point for all of us to hear again and again, is that that whatever we're doing in the moment can be our purpose. Whatever we're doing in the moment can have meaning. It doesn't have to be some, you know, wonderful, grand, you know, other activity or job. You know, so many people I've met along my life are like, oh, I just hate my job. It's just such a drudgery. It's just not what I want to be doing. I wish I was doing something else, something maybe more glamorous or something that was more in tune with who I am. And I get that. And I think that we can strive for, you know, doing things that are more in line with our hearts. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. But also what we're doing right now, we can bring the only meaning and purpose we're going to find with our life is what we bring to it. It's not inherently there in anything. So my thought is that no matter what we're doing, if we're digging sewer trenches, if we bring to it a sense of how is this benefiting others, how is this making the world a better place, how can I bring to this, you know, qualities of being a good person, being a kind person, a more loving person, then no matter what we're doing, there's going to be satisfaction there. There's a little meditation that I do every morning. It's from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and it's just as soon as I wake up in the morning, I open my eyes and I try to remember to say this. I do pretty good with it. Of course, sometimes I forget, but you know, I try to do it every day. And it goes like this. It says, every day, think as you wake up. Today, I am fortunate to be alive. I have a precious human life. I am not going to waste it. I am going to use all my energies to develop myself, to expand my heart out to others, to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I am going to have kind thoughts towards others. I am not going to get angry or think badly about others. I am going to benefit others as much as I can. And I think that's just such a beautiful way of you know, setting our motivation every day, resetting it. We have to reset it again and again. And if we do that, and if we start looking at life in that way, like, this is my motivation, this is, may all my actions be imbued with this motivation, then it really doesn't matter what we do. We can go to work, like, I work in a restaurant often to make money so that I can go and travel and things like that. And I could look at it as like, oh, this is such a drudgery, I just have to do this mundane job. But I try not to. I try to go look at it like, you know what, this job is an opportunity for me to practice my spiritual teachings, you know, that I study. It's an opportunity for me to try to be as positive of a person as I can be, to help others as much as possible on a daily basis in a very real way. You know, it's one thing to sit up on some high throne somewhere teaching, you know, many, many people and telling them how, you know, that they should be good people. But it's another thing to go out there and actually get in the trenches and really try to put it into practice, you know. And that's where I think we need to focus our efforts, you know, and stop looking for, you know, some sort of perfect situation to come along that's going to be, you know, have the capital M meaning for us.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more in that regard. It's, to me, and I was talking with somebody about this the other day, and what's so wonderful, of course, is there are times in our lives when, you know, we get to be in the presence of certain individuals. And it's not always in close proximity, but sometimes it's just enough. And I had the distinct privilege when I was living back in Phoenix to be in the presence of two people that I admire greatly, and one of them, actually both of them, by now have probably been canonized as saints. And the first one is, of course, Mother Teresa of Calcutta.
Oh, yeah.
Saint Teresa of Calcutta is now her given title by the Pope.
Right.
And that's
right.
A wonderful thing. I don't think that she would think too highly of it. It's because that's not her purpose in life to take on these titles. But there are a lot of folks that look to her in that regard. And I understand completely the process. I remember getting challenged about that in terms of, I was producing a program called the Radio Family Rosary Program. And I used to get calls from people who were, conservative, evangelical, fundamentalist Christians saying, how can you do that? You're praying to Mary. They're not actually praying to her in terms of this whole process. They're just asking her to intercede. And isn't that what you do with other people here on this planet?
Sure.
She's not dead. She's in, you know, if you want, she's in heaven. And they're just asking her to intercede for them.
Right.
That's all, you know. So anyway, it to me, it's just really, really, to me, the process of, the other Teresa I was thinking of was Teresa of Avila, who says that God's among the pots and the pans.
Yes, that's great.
And that's the other aspect of it in terms of just doing whatever it is that you're doing right now. I mean, I walk past some gentlemen out here doing some gardening. They're re-landscaping a front yard, probably for low water use and so forth, especially here in California. But, you know, I'm seeing them, and they seem like they're enjoying what they're doing.
Sure.
I know I would, because, my God, you're working right there with the earth, and you're getting your hands right in there, and just, and that's a wonderful feeling. I've had that same feeling when we had chickens, and we have dogs and cats, and we have deer that are occupying the property now where we live, and it's just really very cool.
Right.
But it's one of those things where sometimes we get caught up in the minutiae, if you will. Mm-hmm. In which case, that's when you need to go into the garden with the minutia and fertilize and let that go, because it's so easy to get stuck. Now, how long, and here's the twist, folks, and you may have caught it in the last couple of words that Chris said before we went to break, that you became a Buddhist monk.
That's correct.
How long ago?
I took Buddhist monastic vows in August of 2014, and actually I just returned my vows. That's kind of the terminology that we use, the phraseology that we use. So I decided, for some reasons we can talk about if you like, to give back my vows. But anyway, for 2 years I was a Buddhist monk. I was living in India. I was studying Tibetan language was my main purpose for being there, but I was also studying under His Holiness the Dalai Lama, not formally, but definitely going to his teachings that he gave, because I lived in the town that he lives in. And also His Holiness Karmapa and some other Buddhist teachers as well. So I was studying Buddhism, studying Tibetan language, so I could study the Dharma, is what we call it, the Buddhist teachings in the original Tibetan language.
And I would highly encourage that. That's one of the downfalls of our Western educational system is that all we do is learn everything in English. Of course, there's not a whole lot lost in translation in the context of, for example, studying the Constitution. People still haven't come to grips with certain aspects of the Constitution, and it was written in English.
Sure. Yes, exactly.
It's not the version of English that is that difficult to understand. It wasn't written in the king's English, God forbid, especially when you're talking about the revolution against the king. But I applaud you for that because, what little knowledge I do have of other languages, for example, Sanskrit. I know of a gentleman, his name is Swami Vidyadishananda. He is the founder of the Self-Inquiry Life Fellowship. And he has a monastery here in, or a hermitage, if you will, here in Santa Barbara, actually.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, you're familiar with him?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it, yeah.
And he has, there's a school in England that teaches Sanskrit.
Right.
And not exclusively for the purposes of being able to read and write and speak in the Sanskrit language.
Right.
The process of doing those things, however, they have determined has a profound positive impact on the brain and the synapses.
Right.
And the thinking process of an individual.
Absolutely.
That's amazing to me.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very, just the process of learning a new language has so many benefits, to the brain, to your way of thinking, to your, the flexibility of your brain, being able to think and reason more clearly, things like that. But also just gaining that knowledge, and especially if you're, learning a language and a culture for some other purpose, it can be, really, really helpful. So.
Well, I know when I was growing up in the Catholic Church, I remember thinking that I'll grow up and I'll become a priest. I mean, that was just, the thought that a lot of kids, boys used to have. Yeah. If we went to Mass every Sunday and all this stuff. Of course, at the age of 16, I got up one Sunday morning and my mom said, okay, time to get ready to go to church. Go to Mass. I said, I don't want to go. And she actually said to me, okay, and did not force me to go. Years later, I asked her why, and she says, because I didn't want you to push away from the church. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm no longer a practicing Catholic, but I never pushed away. I'm not an ex-Catholic.
Okay.
I'm not a former Catholic.
Yeah.
I just don't practice that particular philosophy, but I have a great deal of love and admiration for the ritual and the tradition, the ceremony of the church. And I had the great pleasure of being introduced to the Eastern Rite of the Catholic Church.
Oh, beautiful.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. The liturgy is the same every Sunday. And I was lucky enough to be part of a group in Phoenix that actually did much of the service in Slavonic.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was great. I really enjoyed that. I got so much out of that. Although there was one February, it was very warm. They did not have air conditioning in the church. They had all the windows open. Of course, you're burning all the incense. It was still warm, and I nearly passed out. No, I am not bowing to the altar. I am falling down.
Right.
But I think that that's something that we all kind of search for. And we talk about that on this program a lot, too, and that is the aspect of ritual and ceremony and tradition. Yeah. And I know that what little I know of, and you will help me to become a little more enlightened here, about the Buddhist traditions and the rituals and ceremonies. And you, a few years back, you took on those vows.
Right.
That must have been quite an incredible moment for you, one of those great milestones.
It was. And, it was something that I had actually considered very seriously from the moment I started becoming interested in Buddhism. And seriously, I picked up a book on Buddhism just after I came out and got, stepped on the path of recovery. And I became immediately just enamored with the philosophy. And from the beginning, I was like, I think, becoming a monk sounds like something that I would like to do. Definitely something that pulled at my heart. heart. So I thought about it back and forth for about 7 years, but then I did finally, you know, take my monk's vows in Tibet. I was very fortunate to be able to do that, and I was able to go to Tibet and take them in a very traditional way. You know, sitting at the feet of a teacher, you know, taking the vows in Tibetan. I had learned enough Tibetan at that point to be able to sort of know what I was saying and know what was being said to me. But I did understand what was going on, and it was very beautiful and very powerful and very transformative. So,
And in that process, the transformation, as you use that term, what was going through your mind at that moment, at that time of that transformation? Did you think that suddenly, you know, new vistas were going to be open to you? Or was there this sense of, what have I done? this is an awesome challenge to take on.
Yeah, I'm going to answer D on that one, all of the above. Yeah, it was a little bit of everything. It was an exalted moment. There was a great feeling of rejoicing, of gratitude, of celebration, and it just felt wonderful. It's said that once when one takes the vows, whether you're a monk or a nun, that immediately that purifies a huge quantity, lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes of negative karma. So there is this sort of idea that there is a kind of a blissful period that you go through. But then days later or weeks later or however long, or maybe for some people years later, you come face to face with the reality that, okay, just because I'm wearing these clothes, just because I've repeated these words, doesn't mean that I don't have to still work with my mind, that I don't still have to work with who I actually am in this moment. And I have faults and shortcomings and misunderstandings and, things that, all human beings need to work with. So that's when you get into the nitty gritty and you're like, okay, let's then rub the hands together and let's get to work here.
And roll up your sleeves and away you go.
Roll up your sleeves and let's go, So it was, I did realize right away that there was challenges ahead, and in the end, I decided that that the vows were a little bit too constrictive for me. I felt. I went through a long process of, over that 2 years of going back and forth, thinking about whether or not I would continue to be a monk or not. From the beginning, I was thinking, okay, so I've done this. I need to let me just at least stick with this for a year and I'll see how things go. So I got through the first year and then I said, okay, things are okay. Let's just go for one more year and see how things go. And at the end of the 2 years, I decided that, that the vows seemed to be too restrictive for me personally, that they seemed to be too something that was maybe I could too heavy of a burden for me to carry. I'll admit that freely. They're not easy, and they're not meant to be easy either. So in the end, I decided, rather than sit around feeling like horribly guilty about like not being able to keep the vows as purely as I'd like, I'm just going to give them back and continue to be a Buddhist practitioner as a lay practitioner. And I got some good advice from some of my spiritual teachers on that, and was given their blessing to go ahead and return to lay life.
It's interesting because back in, I think it was the early 90s, I wanted to become a member of the Baha'i faith.
Ah, right.
And I thought about it, and I thought, I want to do this. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a letter to the diocese in Phoenix, and I took it to them. A little shocked at the response.
Okay. What did they say?
We'll put this in your file.
Okay.
I'm thinking, you and the FBI. Okay, fine. And I thought, okay, nothing I can do about it. You've got a file on me. So be it.
Yeah.
And I became a member of the Baha'i faith. And there were I want to say 8 or 10 criterion, that you had to adhere to, and as far as the process of that transformation, that transition, I couldn't make the last one.
Okay.
I couldn't make the last one. It wasn't a rejection per se. It was just for some reason. Well, I knew the reason, and that was because when I became a member of the Baha'i faith, I was looking for a group to belong to.
Right.
And when I got to that point a year and a half in, I realized that I had, from my perspective, joined under false pretenses.
Right.
I didn't join because I believed, not that I disbelieved, but the underlying factor was I needed a group to accept me and allow me to be who I am and ask questions and so forth.
Right.
So I called up the gal whose home we used to visit, she and her husband, and I shared this with her, and she says, don't worry about it. I said, if this is really what you want to do, then we will take your name off of the list. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow.
Oh, wow, that's official.
And yeah, and you can come back anytime you like.
Oh,
and I just, and of course, I felt so good about that. And I still have all of the books that I purchased over the year and a half from the founder and all of the other writings and so forth. And it was an incredible experience. It was a wonderful experience, and it's something I needed to go through. And I'm glad that I did it. You know, I don't adhere to one specific philosophy to this day. It's I'm coming to the smorgasbord table too, like everybody else, and saying, "Oh, I like that. Nah, no, thank you. That didn't." I mean, I've and when it comes to literal food, real food, there have been things that I have tried. Mm-hmm. I often say jokingly that I'll try anything once, sometimes twice. I tried some. There's this this fermentation festival that goes on here in California, and some folks brought in these fermented olives, still with the pit in them.
Yeah,
I tried one, and that is the only one I will ever try.
Right.
But I think that that's one of the things that we get scared off of in terms of even investigating. I have to say that even from my standpoint, there is an uneasiness, and I want to do this, but there's an uneasiness about researching and studying, and in this day and age, the Quran and the Muslim faith and philosophy.
Right.
Because especially if you do it online, because of all of the red flags it will throw up to whoever is watching or listening. You know, it's like you can't even broaden your horizons and your educational perspective and your views on things without fear of retribution.
Yeah.
Or criticism and so forth.
Right.
When it comes to this process of Buddhism, quite honestly, there would be those who would look at Buddhism and say, well, it's pretty innocuous. It's not a big deal. It's a pacifist philosophy. You know, we don't have to worry about them taking up arms.
I don't know.
Well, there are all kinds of folks in all different philosophies. No matter how pacifistic the philosophy is, there will be those who will, you know, take it to the next level from their perspective. But what's your thought about our understanding of one another, and then of course our willingness to step out and find out who and what the other people are all about and their philosophies and the ways of thinking?
I think generally speaking, I don't want to sound too judgmental here, but I think, and I'm talking about myself too, of course, I think generally speaking, we're terrible at it, in this point in history. And what I like about Buddhism is it kind of addresses this issue, you know, quite clearly. This is part of our problem. This is one of the sources of our suffering, is that we cling to ourselves and our ego and our view and our opinions and our beliefs so fiercely and so dearly that we're unable to see the views and beliefs and opinions of others clearly. We're unable to see that, in fact, every other human being, and not only every other being, but every other sentient being, in fact, on Earth is more similar to us than we'd like to normally, or that we normally see. That every sentient being, in fact, every human being has the same drive that we do to be happy, and every sentient being around us has the same drive to avoid suffering. You know, so these are very important similarities that we simply forget about because we're so obsessed with our own happiness and our own wish to avoid suffering, and so we build these walls around us, and we become very defensive and sometimes quite aggressive as well. So I think it's a big problem, and I think it's something that really all the world's religions do address at one point or another. But in my opinion, I think Buddhism addresses it with the most thoroughness. It offers a clear assessment of the problem. It offers a clear path to solve the problem. And if you follow the steps, it's possible to, I'm not saying that I have, but I'm saying it's possible to find that solution.
Yeah, and it is a solution that needs to be found. Although I have to say that when all of this started to unfold in the last 15 or 20 years, the one thought that came to me was, well, every philosophy, every religion seems to get its turn at trying to subjugate the rest of the population.
Yeah, sure.
It's their turn. I mean, that, you know, it's like, okay, the Catholics had the Inquisition and, you know, and all of that.
Yeah.
And now it's their turn. And the Buddhists are next, you know.
Well, if you go back and look at Buddhist history too, in Tibet, they have their black spots in their history as well. So
Nobody has a clean slate per se.
Straight. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, the truth is the truth, but you know, we're human beings, and we're heir to human, right? So we're always bringing our own, you know, foibles to the table, and it colors the truth is all. And so it's a matter of just working through that.
And that's where we need to step forward and take a look at that and say, hey, you know, because for myself, I have wanted to just understand, you know, just have a better perspective. Because one of the things that I find so fascinating is how quickly people come to judgment, rush to judgment before they have all, if not all of the facts, a sufficient amount of facts to come to another conclusion. I watch a lot of these and only because my wife is more interested in them than I am, but I watch a lot of these police dramas,
okay,
television or movies, either way.
Yeah.
And I see how quickly the detectives reach their conclusion even before all of the evidence not only has been gathered and processed, but evaluated.
Sure.
And then you go down the road, and then we see that in our day-to-day lives. We see people who are exonerated through DNA evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's like, wait a minute, hold on just a second. What is the judicial process actually about finding out what the truth is, or is it just about winning and losing? And, you know, there would be those who would say it's the latter. That's all it is about.
Yeah.
And God forbid you should get caught up in that process.
Right.
You better hope you win, because the alternative is that you could be there, you know, be incarcerated for quite a long time.
Yeah.
The process that you went through, that you made the decision, I don't think this is for me. It's not serving me anymore. Was there a particular moment? Were there a particular series of events? Or was this just sort of a collective, you know, a cumulative process over the two or three years, that led you to the decision?
It was a cumulative process, for sure. I can definitely say that, you know. And it was something that, I kept on just telling myself, okay, look, I can't just take the vows and 2 weeks later say, oh, this is not for me, because, you know, you've got to at least try. So with whatever you decide to do, whether it's a new job or you know, a new project or whatever. So you know, there's always going to be difficulties. So so I had to look at it very closely, and I did a lot of journaling on it. I did a lot of talking with, you know, some close friends and things like that. But mostly I had to work through it myself. And yeah, I just decided at the end that it just wasn't for me. That was okay. There was nothing wrong with that. There was no shame in that. You know, that's a big problem for us Westerners. We've got a lot of shame issues and things. So I needed to make sure that I was being healthy about it and respecting my decision. So Yeah, you know, there's some moments where I'm thinking now, you know, I'm transitioning back into lay life right now. It's only been about a month or so. And there are moments where I'm like, man, have I made the right choice? And then I'm like, yeah, I have. So, yeah, I'm becoming more and more at peace with it and more excited about the future. So, you know, by no means does this mean that I'm ending my relationship with the Dharma, with Buddhism. I'm more enthused about it than ever, it feels. So I feel really excited about the future and things that are coming.
Well, that's very cool. I'm excited for you in that respect, because it's one of those things that is not easy to do. I know this because I've been through that myself. And again, with the Baha'i faith, Catholicism, it wasn't something that I consciously chose, although there would be those who would say, well, you did because before you came into this life.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I can accept that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I think about that from the standpoint of thinking long and hard about making a decision like that.
Yeah.
Because if you're really going to do that, I mean, it's honestly, to me, that is as paramount as moving from where you live today to a place that you have never been. I did that once when I was 21. Yeah. I moved to Boise, Idaho with a buddy of mine thinking, I'm moving out of the house. Well, my sisters were mad because they wanted to be the first ones to move out.
Yeah.
I have two older sisters, and they were in college and so forth.
Right.
And I moved up there when I was 21 thinking I'm going to live there.
Yeah.
And I tried for a month. I tried to get myself established. And of course, I cut all my ties in Phoenix. Yeah. And it took me a year to reestablish them all when I went back after that month. And I was sort of disappointed that I hadn't made it work there. But by the same token, you know, hey, I moved to Santa Barbara, even though we'd visited here a number of times, so I was somewhat familiar. It was still an adjustment. And of course, we want to move, for example, our ultimate goal is to move to Ireland and live there the rest of our days.
Okay.
I mean, honestly, that is really, it's really what I want more than anything else, to have the opportunity to live, you know, in that place, in that space.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just, you know, it's just something that is, to me, it's everybody has to make up their own mind, and they've got to find their own place in the universe, is like kind of what we were talking about before.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, we have to, you know, part of our path, part of our reason for being here is to learn to listen to our heart, to really develop a relationship with our inner wisdom. You know, sometimes that can be very tricky. You know, sometimes what we take to be our inner wisdom and the voice of our heart is actually just our fear, maybe. So we need to learn how to differentiate between what's our true intuition and what is just maybe what I call like the death throes of the ego, maybe. You know, as we're working on the spiritual path, we're definitely working on kind of being free, and part of that means being free from the ego and the illusion of the ego. So yeah. So I think it's great. I think it's great. We got to all listen to our hearts.
Exactly. And you've done that going both directions. And you made the decision to become a Buddhist monk. Mm-hmm. Then you made the decision that this really wasn't for you. At the same time, I would venture that the practices, that the education, if you will, the experiences, those are things that have shaped you and molded you into who you are, to where you may not wear the robes and you may not have the vows to adhere to, but still somewhere inside there is a Buddhist monk that resides.
I really appreciate you saying that. That really touches my heart. I hope that's the case. I do believe that's the case, and I hope to, like I say, you know, I'm looking forward to continuing my practice. I'm looking forward to. There's so much to learn in life in general, but in the Buddhist tradition especially, there's just so much to learn and so many wonderful, skillful ways that we can train our minds to become kinder people, more loving people, more generous people, better human beings. So so I want to continue this path for the rest of my life. So yeah, like I say, I really appreciate you saying that. That touches me deeply. Thank you.
You're welcome. Before I let you go, I want to ask you, or I want to mention to our listeners, I guess, first of all, that this program continues on beyond the radio broadcast. If you want to hear the entire interview with Chris and I want you to go to RichardDugan.com, the radio shows page, click on the link, and you will be able to hear the entire interview that goes on for more than an hour. Second thing, Chris, is if I would like to invite you, if you should find your path meandering through the San Ynez Mountains and here in the Central Coast, we'd love to have you in studio to continue our conversation.
That would be wonderful. I humbly accept your invitation, and I hope to be able to do it soon. That would be great.
And then the next thing, folks, is I want to remind you that he has written a book. It's his memoirs. It is called The Narrow Way. And it is a memoir of coming out, getting clean, and finding Buddha. And I think that would have been a fascinating experience, Chris, to have actually experienced the Buddha at the base of the Bodhi tree when he got it.
I made a pilgrimage to that spot many times. It's a very, very special place in my heart and in many people's hearts. It's a wonderful place. So you can still feel the energy resonating from that air, from that spot. It's quite amazing. Yeah.
And before we let you go, I have three questions that I ask my guests. And again, thank you so much for the time that you've shared with us here on the program.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
First question is, who is Chris Lemmig?
Chris Lemming is an ex-Buddhist monk, an ex-drunk, and now stumbling along, continuing on the path to enlightenment.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Humbly speaking, I would just like to help as many people as possible to just live lives that are happier, more fulfilling, and a little bit more meaningful. Nothing really too grand about that, nothing too exalted, just in a very simple and a very practical way.
And what is your life's purpose?
I think my life's purpose is to grow spiritually as much as I can with as many people as I can and just give it the old college try.
Okay. Fair enough. And again, I thank you so much for today and for the time that you've taken and wish you much success in the process that you're going through. May you very well achieve that peace and tranquility and equanimity, if you will, that we're all sort of searching for. And I hope that folks can glean from you what we've talked about today, and even pick up a copy of The Narrow Way.
Thank you so much, Richard. I really appreciate being on your show. I had a real pleasure here. It was great.
And also, the website is Chris Lemmig. That's C-H-R-I-S-T. There is no T. What am I saying?
There is no T.
C-H-R-I-S-L-E-M-I-G.com.
Yeah.
And we will be linked to your website. Folks can get more information about you as well as the book, The Narrow Way.
Yes.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.